You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for September 6th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the People's Freehold of Siskiyou, it's The Professional Left with Drift Glass and Blue Gal.
Siskiyou?
I think that's right.
Bless you.
Yeah. But it's currently Siskiyou County, but if the managers of the county have their way, it will be its own country or its own...
This is in California?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're seceding from the union?
They're seceding from the state, although I don't know where that leaves them.
Yeah.
In terms of their relationship to the rest of the other 49 states.
Yeah.
So unless they're going to declare themselves a free and independent land, I don't know what, but take a wild guess what their political party is.
Now, Tea Party?
Yeah. Take a wild guess.
How did I know that?
It's just.
How did I know that? Yeah. Well, they're way north. They're on the Oregon border.
Uh-huh. Although part of me wants to let these people just go. I really do want the tri-corner hat idiots just to leave, just to say, finally, you know what? Slavery's over. You get to keep all your crackpot anti-science ideas, your antediluvian notions about everything, your bad math, your stupid science, and your idiotic opinions. You get to make entirely your own country out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And good luck and God bless.
Yep.
That's so long and thanks for all the fish, my friends. To all of our listeners who celebrate traditional Rosh Hashanah or the traditional war on Rosh Hashanah.
No one has talked about the war on Rosh Hashanah.
I'm sure on Fox they're throwing up a couple of... Shana Tov and all you good people out there. Happy 5774 to one and all.
Wonkette said they're going to be writing 5773 on their checks forever, though.
Isn't that the way? Isn't that always the way?
Drift Glass.
Yeah, Blue Gal.
I want to set up an analogy.
What does that mean?
An analogy to the United States. It's Friday morning. We're adding a little on to the podcast this morning. We just heard our president talk about small countries that he's talking to at the G20 summit.
Yeah.
And how they don't envy Obama because they're a small country and that no one's ever going to ask them to do anything about chemical weapons in Syria.
Right. Right.
And you and I have been talking about this all week.
Yeah.
What it's like, and this is the analogy, what it's like to be the tallest guy in the bar.
Yeah.
Which you always are.
I almost
always am.
You're
in a bar. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, when I'm out grocery shopping, which I do a lot, I am approached by nice little ladies all the time to get the thing off the top shelf.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's sweet and I'm happy to do it. And it makes me feel good that I've done my good deed. And it warms my heart. So when it comes to that.
Yeah.
When it comes to the international effort to get the food off the top shelf for people.
Oh, and when you moved down here, we increased our storage space in the kitchen immensely because the area above the kitchen cabinets is now reachable by someone in the house.
Exactly.
And that doesn't preclude you hitting your head constantly on the basement ceiling. But
constantly. I wear a bike helmet down there.
Yeah.
But that's the,
you know, this is what happens when you're over 6'7".
Yeah.
And you're in a bar.
Yes.
And some asshole decides to start a fight.
Well, either with you or with somebody.
Or with anybody. Or with the bartender. And they don't have a bouncer.
You need to go break that fight up.
Yeah.
So here are your scenarios. Every eye turns to you. Why aren't you stepping in to stop these other two guys from fighting?
Let's just say it's just that one guy because he started the fight. The other guy didn't want to. And
I know.
I'm making this an analogy with Syria because we apparently have one asshole. There's just one asshole.
There's just one
asshole. It's government that's doing this thing.
He's such a dick. Let me make the analogy a little more complicated.
Okay.
The two scenarios in the bar is either the person picks a fight with you.
Mm-hmm.
Because fuck you. Who do you think you are? God damn it.
And I can tell you've been through this a time or two.
And this isn't everybody. Yeah. There's just always a certain number of dicks in a bar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who just have friggin' radar for conflict.
Well, and I have never understood mean drunks and why they even bother. getting drunk, but
because, you know, it gives them an excuse to be loud about it. Visit my comment section sometime. You'll find I'm hanging out there. But so the scenario one is their radar locks on to the guy whose head is above the rest of the crowd, and they target because there's something in them that drives them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's a couple of guys at the end of the bar having a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And to make it more complicated, I'm not sure who started it.
Yeah.
The rebels are pretty dicey people who have really, really bad history and bad paper.
Mm-hmm.
And the government of Syria is a mass murdering despot.
Yep.
So, but it's okay. Now you need to step in and break the fight up. We're not going to do it, but you're the tall guy.
Yeah.
So step in. And here's the problem. The problem with being the tall guy in the bar, and this is, I realize I'm being facile about analogizing a bar fight to what's going on in a complex international situation. But there is, if you are the guy breaking the fight up, there's no way you're going to win.
No, right. Ever.
Maybe in Roadhouse, Patrick Swayze wasn't actually taller than everybody, and he was very cool.
He had the greatest hair, though.
I don't. But he could, he would talk everybody out and try to be peaceful, man. Let me buy you a drink, man. And then he would kill you. But there's no way the tall guy in the bar ever wins a fight. Because no matter what you do, the minute you swing on somebody, you're the bad guy. Because you're the big guy.
Yeah.
You're the big guy. Everyone is looking to you to fix this problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's that sort of everyone takes a giant step backward.
Yeah.
And you're standing there like an idiot going, I guess I'm in charge of fixing this problem then.
Yeah. And totally responsible if it doesn't get fixed.
Exactly. If it doesn't get fixed, if the fight is not settled amicably to everyone's satisfaction,
it's your fault.
You're never going to win again, because the minute the guy who's over 6'7"
mm-hmm.
takes a swing at the guy who's 5'9"
mm-hmm. or 5'4",
you've lost.
Sure. Yeah.
You've lost because you are picking on that poor little guy. Why couldn't you find a better solution? Why? And none of which is to say that being very tall or very smart don't have huge advantages, especially mm-hmm. in a culture that worships those things, except, of course, when you actually manifest them in a way that makes people feel threatened, in which case they don't want you around.
Yeah, and I've noticed that about you from the very beginning. You're very good at wrapping your body around people in a way that is not threatening. And you're good at putting yourself on their level, talking to them calmly, not being intimidating, not broadening out your shoulders. Sort of, hey, how you doing? Blah, you know.
And I've had more than once. I've had people not get on an elevator or get on an elevator, turn around, and notice me, and actually go, oh, because it's oh my god, there's this big guy looming.
Well,
over.
And when you're wearing your shades and your leather jacket, you're a narc.
Or I'm in the building to kill someone. I'm looking for a Sarah Connor.
Yes.
And that is a useful tool in the toolkit of tall guys and powerful nations.
Yeah.
That is in my case white privilege. White privilege with additional add-on tools that other people don't have.
Yeah.
By the same token, if you're the person that everyone looks to fix the problem.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's a situation where there's no good solution.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to end up eating it if you step in.
Yeah.
If you can't end it in a Capra-esque way
mm-hmm.
where everyone goes home happy, if there's no way for you to fix it in a way that makes everybody happy, you walk away the bad guy, no matter what happens.
But see, this is why I think diplomacy needs to be promoted as our goal. Because one thing I've noticed in the few high school fights that I've seen is the male teachers come out.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's almost policy that the male teachers, if they're going to break up a fight, they'll make sure there's two of them. The gym teacher and the science teacher come out together, break up the fight so that, if a kid gets a swing at him, there's two adults there saying, no, the biology teacher did not hit the kid, and it's protecting everybody from that. And if you're fortunate enough in a bar fight to have two tall guys or three or, the basketball team is there.
Yeah.
Then you can go, Joe, let's you and I go over and make sure these guys get in a cab,
exactly.
and separate cabs.
Well, if I can make If I could draw,
and then it's not all your fault, you know. Then and I feel like the United States need. The problem is the United States doesn't have any ally. China is only worried about gas prices going up as a result of this, and Russia is being a dick because they can.
Yeah.
And so we don't have another. I don't like this argument of, well, we're the only superpower left, so we have to do something.
No.
That's bullshit. No. But the fact that the other two largest countries in the world, largest economies and largest countries, Germany doesn't want to do anything because of inflation. China doesn't want to do anything because of oil. Yeah. China doesn't want to do anything because of gas prices, and Russia's being a dick. We don't have anyone standing up to help us. And the Arab League doesn't want to do anything because they have to ask Israel permission to do anything, which makes them look bad.
And so, the reason
their own people.
And there's an actual bar, an actual fictional barroom situation. It now occurs to me. No, there's an actual fictional barroom situation in a classic black and white movie.
Oh.
Victor Laszlo doesn't get the people to sing La Marseillaise.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't get the band to play it.
Nope.
Not until Bogart nods.
Rick says it's okay. Yeah.
Until Rick says it's okay. You need them both to win the fight.
Yep.
But not until the guy who actually controls
who's
the
got the power.
Bar
yep.
Tells the guy who's willing to step up and take action, I've got your back.
Yeah.
Do things move.
Yep.
And I'd also point out that there's a great virtue in having nice old ladies run the world. And I'll tell you why. If you go to Wrigley Field, the people who will seat you and who will monitor the aisles and who will stand there and make sure fights don't break out are almost invariably grandmothers and grandfather types.
As we call them, LOLs, little old ladies. Not,
because,
just say that with the full understanding that I'm heading there very quickly.
Yeah. And but the point being, I know you're not. But,
yes, I am.
Oh, trust me, baby. But you don't pick a fight with grandma.
No. You don't let any blood get on your mom.
No. I'm not saying that that's directly analogous in any way to Syria. There are consequences to being the largest and most macho military in the world that everyone else just says, okay, well, America will deal with it. I don't have to deal with it. Gulf states, fuck it. We don't have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Europe, let them handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just see how big a broken nose the big guy walks away with. Won't that be funny? Because it's no skin off ours. And that's a really untenable position to be in.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
The way you fix it is you build something like almost a United Nations or a League of Nations of some kind.
It won't work.
Or Michael Rennie comes to Earth with a robot and says, all right, you people quit screwing around or I'm nuking the whole place.
Yeah, and that unites everybody.
Yeah. But remember how he does it? His threats are made good by turning the power off.
Yep.
Just passively turning the power off.
Yeah.
And not in the hospitals.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just in trap. And it was this really gentle reminder that we are so much more powerful than you.
Yeah.
That you really would be wise not to screw around anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that message of the projection of tremendous power through the gentlest possible reminder that you don't want to cross that line. Mm-hmm. Is the wisest of all diplomacy.
And that's also the grandma way to do it. I mean, if I want my kids to pay attention to me turning off the lights in the room where they're fighting.
Does it?
Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah. And we're so far away from that in our world that it's sad.
Yeah.
But that's how human beings are best dealt with in large numbers, in my experience, speaking as a human being. I know what I respond to. And I'm not saying a homicidal dictator or a mass murderer would respond to grandma saying, please don't kill them.
Yeah.
But there are better ways to do this. And we're so far down a bad road right now that walking us back to a place where we're more effective because we're more gentle and considered and thoughtful, undoing the real damage of Iraq, which was squandering our reputation.
Yeah.
Doing something monumentally stupid, lying ourselves into doing that monumentally stupid thing, and then fucking it up, and then calling everybody who disagreed with us a traitor, calling people like us, liberals, traitors for asking questions. That just scorched the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could ever walk that back, if we could ever replant that land, that would be a good thing. I don't know how we do it, but I wish we could.
Well, and I am grateful for this opportunity that the universe gave us to step back for a minute and have this conversation. And I hope that I can focus. And again, I'm really focusing on not telling anyone else what to do.
Right.
But I can focus on discussing what the right thing is to do without demonizing people who disagree with me.
That is not to say that going into Siri is a good idea.
I was just thinking about all of us hipsters, including myself, who wore Darfur t-shirts.
Yeah.
Because there was murder going on.
Yeah.
And the international community wasn't doing enough about it. And I meant militarily intervening with the people that had machetes and were killing people.
Yeah.
You know, that this needed to stop. Mm-hmm. And we're still not doing anything about Africa at all because they don't have oil. Hey, you know. Yeah,
they're not of any value. They're not, well, they're not in the middle. They're not strategically located anywhere near anything we care about.
Yeah, exactly.
They're just people.
Yep.
They're just people.
They're just human beings, fellow human beings on this earth. Yep, yep. Yep. And Pol Pot. I mean, people have brought that up. Same thing, you know, the killing fields. And.
But our vocabulary for talking about this has been so polluted by Iraq.
It has.
And I would argue going back to the Clinton administration, because I want to get to a few quotes.
Oh, yeah. Well,
our vocabulary, and this is a little bit of a sidestep, but starting with Newt Gingrich, of all people, our vocabulary for talking to each other was so destroyed by
Newt Gingrich.
Newt Gingrich's insistence that Republicans adopt a language that was entirely hostile, confrontational, and derogatory and slanderous towards liberals and Democrats, and that they use that vocabulary every time they open their mouth. And that's been going on now for 20 friggin' years. A deliberate, consistent, a focused, loud effort to make sure that anybody to the left of the right is completely delegitimized all the time about everything. And therefore, all action that goes to delegitimizing those liberal monsters must therefore be legitimate.
And the irony is that he has helped to, I think, destroy the Republican Party's national prospects.
Oh, he has.
For two generations. Yeah.
He has.
That a U.S. senator on the Foreign Relations Committee would bring up the IRS scandal in front of the Secretary of State and just start spouting Hannity talking points to drum up his gullible base while we're actually talking about whether or not we're going to do a military strike because of chemical weapons. I mean, it hasn't changed. It hasn't changed.
Well, it did change. And the point I wanted to make was it changed
when
temporarily.
Republicans put their hand on the Bible. Yeah,
absolutely. The minute George Bush put his hand on the Bible, all of these highfalutin, we got to be skeptical. We've got to keep a close eye on this. And even if it looks like there might be a hint of impropriety, we should have a hearing. All that went out the door. But if you go back to the Clinton years,
people are comparing this to Kosovo. I'm not sure that's I'm not sure that's a good comparison. But read these quotes and tell us who said them. These are from the time of Kosovo, correct?
And exactly. And this is the point being, there was a time in American history when there was a Democratic president who was scandal ridden largely because of crap that Republicans made up about him. Who they made very clear they would obstruct and block and hopefully run out of town on a rail, and were entirely focused on destroying him by any means necessary, up to and including impeachment. And that those people are now an order of magnitude crazier than they were then. So it is useful to remember that when Clinton went before the Congress to talk about intervening in Kosovo, Republicans and conservatives were loath to support him.
I don't remember this part of American history very well. Was there an authorization to use force in Kosovo?
There was from the Senate, I believe. The House was like screwing around, so then he went in.
Okay.
So it was probably illegal. or it depends on how you define war powers and presidential powers.
Oh, as we know that the creeping increase in executive power, and we've been talking about that for a long time. Okay.
But it's useful to remember that not everybody in a discussion about presidential power and the authorization to commit to go to war comes to the table in good faith.
Yeah.
They come to the table to destroy the opposition. And if kneecapping the president when he comes and asks you for permission. And just so listen to these quotes from people who absolutely roasted Bill Clinton. And then remember how all of this high-flown skepticism and rhetoric and talk about constitutional and caution and care went completely out the window the minute George Bush touched the Bible. So here we go. The president is once again releasing American military might on a foreign country with an ill-defined objective and no exit strategy. He has yet to tell the Congress how much this operation will cost, and he has not informed our nation's armed forces about how long they will be away from home. These strikes do not make for a sound foreign policy. Rick Santorum, senator from Pennsylvania.
Now, see, he had those words in his wheelhouse to say.
Yeah.
And he could have said them to Bush.
He could have. Every one of these people could have said them to. You know who else could have said them to Bush? Karen Hughes.
Who worked in the Bush White House.
Who was Bush spokesman. Here's what Karen Hughes said. If we're going to commit American troops, we must be certain that they have a clear mission, an achievable goal, and an exit strategy. You know who else could have talked to George Bush?
His dad.
George Bush. Who was then governor of Texas, who said victory means exit strategy. And it's important for the president to explain to us what the exit strategy is.
Well, and I do want to say his father, H.W. Bush, there have been lots of the books that have been written after the war talk about H.W. Bush having huge concerns about lack of exit strategy in Iraq.
Yeah.
And he butted out of it because respect for the office of president, and I'm not going to get involved. I'm not going to be – there's one commander in chief, and I have to sit back. And besides, he's Barbara's son.
Right.
Don't interfere with Barbara's little boy.
No.
But he was really freaked out by the lack of exit strategy. Kept asking his friends in Texas, is there an exit strategy? What's going to happen? And, you know, no one could answer that question because there wasn't one.
And if you'll remember, the State Department spent decades planning for a lot of contingencies for when the U.S. invaded, because contingency planning is what people do. They don't necessarily want these things to happen, but they plan for it.
Yeah.
And there was an entire post-Iraq invasion occupation and reconstruction plan that went on for a million pages and covered every little friggin' detail. It might have worked. It might have not. But the Defense Department and the White House told the State Department to go piss up a rope.
Yeah.
And we'll do it ourselves. And we know what we're doing. And they put a bunch of neoconservatives.
I was going to say that the exit strategy was we will be greeted as liberators.
Yeah. Everything will be fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll lop off the 52 heads of the 52 heads of the government and everything will work out.
Fire the army.
And fire 300,000 men with guns and everything will work out fine. And the State Department said, are you can't be serious.
Mm-hmm.
And they were told to leave the room.
Mm-hmm.
And so we lied our way into it, and then we botched it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we told everybody who thought that we were really about to make a big mistake or were in the process of making a big mistake, or do you see now how big a mistake this was? We call, you know, the right called all those people traitors. They polluted the ability of this country to have a conversation. For example, Joe Scarborough, a Republican of Florida, said, well, I just think it's a bad idea. What's going to happen is they're going to be over there for 10, 15, maybe 20 years.
Oh, my God.
20 years. Quagmire. And, of course, there was no one more concerned about supporting the president during war or peace, standing behind your commander-in-chief than Senator Richard Lugar, who said, this is the president's war. And when he falls flat on his face, that's his problem.
Oh, my God.
And I want to do one more. There's a ton of these, but I want to do just one more because it's so friggin' – oh, yes. Explain to the mothers and fathers of American servicemen that may come home in body bags why their sons and daughters had to give up their life. Sean Hannity, Fox News.
Yep.
April 6th, 1999.
Fox rocks!
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They went from there to Iraq and made soldiers yell into microphones, Fox rocks.
Well, it was a great and glorious conquest, and it was a cause for celebration. You had Oliver North on the eve of invasion over there stuffing microphones in the faces of soldiers and say, go ahead, say Fox rocks. All I'm saying is if you want to have a debate about Syria, and we really should, I personally think it's a stupid idea. It's I understand the impulse, but I haven't heard anything that weighs against the futility of doing it. I might in the future, but I haven't so far. But
I'm worried about two things. One is that we're actually going to result in releasing more chemical weapons into the air.
Yeah.
And number two, make Assad stronger. Or bring Al-Qaeda into the picture. I mean, no nice people.
Ahmed Chalabi is still looking for work. So, you know,
he's underemployed, really?
Yes. You could go in there. But if you want to have a serious debate about a serious issue, you have to make sure that the people who spent the last 20 years vilifying everything every Democrat has said,
yep,
and uncritically celebrating the Bush administration are not allowed to the table.
Right, they're because they allowed... had the capability of questioning war when it was a Democratic president.
And they told us to go stuff it.
Yep.
And I would also say that the people who have, and this again will make probably some people upset, I'm not going to name names, but if you have been a member of the liberal caucus who has been saying Barack Obama is worse than George Bush since practically the day he was inaugurated, mm-hmm, and has had nothing but, you know, contempt for Barack Obama, and has, and I've found a lot of what he did to be bad or wrong or stupid or disappointing or aggravating or infuriating. But if your entire leitmotif for the last 5 years has been Barack Obama is worse than Bush and always deploys military power to kill innocent people on purpose, because that's just what he does. Those people don't belong at the table either.
Mm-hmm.
Those people might very well make for passionate allies for a couple of weeks, but they make terrible people on your side because their arguments are so over the top and all based on the supposition that the person who disagrees with me is evil.
I want to go a little bit off topic, Driftglass. Uh-huh. I did want to tell you that I was on the phone this week with a friend of mine who was an ardent Hillary Clinton supporter in 2008. And she told me that she was so angry with Barack Obama for how he treated Hillary Clinton in the 2008 primary that she can't support Hillary Clinton because Hillary Clinton worked for Obama. So this time around, she can't support Hillary Clinton because Hillary Clinton apparently forgave the unforgivable. I don't know how else to put that. My eyes glazed over at that point. I think she's in the vast minority of Hillary Clinton supporters, and she'll know that I'm talking about her, but and I did disagree with her vehemently on the phone, let her know, you know, Hillary Clinton is a human being. I do think there are a few in the minority supporters of Hillary Clinton in 2008 who forgot that she's a human being and she was a wish fulfillment device for them,
yeah,
rather than a politician and a person and someone who has professional goals that go far beyond fulfilling, you know, whatever desires you personally have for the future of politics in America. So
just as Barack Obama was not the liberal savior, I was hoping he would do a lot of things that he didn't do, and I was hoping he would learn lessons that any person could learn about
politics. Absolutely, he should have learned that he had to go bully pulpit, full campaign swing,
all the time,
and he didn't do that.
Perfectly valid. Everybody should have their heart broken in politics. I mean, everybody should have their heart ripped out of their chest and smashed to bits in politics, because they're a bunch of basically bureaucrats and seducers whose job it is to persuade me to give them a lot of power, and then they will go off and disappoint me.
Yeah.
And you pick the best puppy in the litter.
Mm-hmm. You're starting to sound like Steve King. He never disappoints. Steve King never disappoints.
It's like the Bible. There's a role for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
There are thieves and there are liars and there are saints and there are whores and there are judges and there are Philistines. And there's a place for everyone in our political there's a role for everyone in our political conversation. But there's some people you just shouldn't listen to.
Yeah.
And there's some people you should probably listen to more. And the more I travel around this block and learn how politics work, the more I'm confirmed in my liberalness, but I'm also confirmed in my pragmatism and how hard it is to actually get where I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that
This Syria situation is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
We want justice for the people of Syria who are victimized in this situation.
Uh-huh.
We don't want to turn away from them. At the same time, we don't want to make things worse.
Right.
And that's just a terrible, difficult problem to solve. And then we've got this thing called democracy and a free press, so to speak.
And it's not a terrible thing to have your first rule in democracy being the same as the first rule in medicine, which is do no harm.
Yeah. Well, and there was an article in the LA Times this week about I had to print it out for the young man who has to bring articles about the economy to his class for extra credit. And China's concern about the economy and how any action in Syria will impact the economy. That's their number one thing, apparently.
Yeah.
And but it talked about China pushing for diplomatic solutions to this and also looking for ways that militarily that Syria's ability to use chemical weapons can be diminished without making it worse.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's all of that's the goal of everyone.
And I suggest in the future for the young man.
Yeah.
Just print off a lot of Ron Paul newsletters from the 90s about gold and fiat currency.
Yeah, that's good.
And have him bring that stuff in and just see what happens then. Extra credit.
Rand Paul's speech about restaurants.
That'd be good. That'd go over really well in consumer ed class.
In consumer ed class.
Yeah. How much gold do you have? You know, Glenn Beck makes a lot of sense.
You're listening to the Professional Left Podcast, professionalleft.blogspot.com.
I want you to respond then to those who are claiming that some of us
yes.
are more interventionist than we would be because there's a Democrat in the White House. Because I sense that it's a different situation than the Republicans. Am I making any sense? Probably
yeah. not. Well,
I'm not supporting intervention in Syria because Obama is suggesting it. I'm saying we need to weigh this situation, and that my initial reaction, I want to go back to what I said last week because I made a lot of people mad at me, apparently.
Right.
I said bomb the shit out of them because I was what I was saying. And if you go back and listen to it, you'll hear me again say my initial emotional gut response. And I did say initial on the podcast was bomb the shit out of them for using chemical weapons against children. My initial gut response was, and that's what I meant, knowing that I'm not making that decision and that I am being visceral about it. And thank God I'm not making that decision.
This is why they don't let the children of or the parents of murdered children sit on juries.
On the jury. Exactly. This is why.
Is there a more cruel way we can find to kill this person?
Yeah.
Because that's what I would do. Yeah.
And that should have been Massachusetts governor. What was his name again? The guy who ran for president.
Yes, Tank Hat.
Yeah, Tank Hat. Michael Dukakis.
Thank you.
Yeah. That should have been Michael Dukakis' answer to what if your wife was raped?
Of course, yeah.
I wouldn't be on the jury because I would want to kill the guy. Of course I would.
You can't let people. And
let crime victims be on the jury of the people that are going to make, you know. Right, you can't do that. You can't put them on the jury. Yeah.
About what do you say to people who are...
I think you're supporting the president so much that, of course, you're going to be in favor of Syrian intervention.
My response is go read my blog. I'm not. I think it's probably a bad idea. I don't think it's particularly useful. I don't think anything can be accomplished. I have no idea why we're not waiting for the United Nations. I have no idea why the Gulf states aren't more interested in their own.
Oh, I know exactly why the Gulf states aren't involved, but that's because they need, quote unquote, permission from Israel to do anything. And as you said, they'd rather chew their own arm off than be beholden to the Israeli army, quote unquote, letting them intervene in another Arab's country's war. So,
it sounds counterintuitive, but arguments over parking spaces should be passionate and people should throw things. Arguments over going to war should be very carefully.
And that's why I'm grateful that we stepped back for a few minutes and that we are having this conversation as a country.
Yes.
I think that's a good thing.
And I don't. Chris Hayes had a really good piece Wednesday on. He said two things I think are really bear repeating. And the first is toward the end there, he was saying this is a panel discussion on how to make a decision, not what your decision should be, but how you should go about making it. And rule number one is you have to everyone who's a neoconservative who ballyhooed the Iraq war before, during and after needs to be gotten the hell out of the room. They have no business participating in this conversation at all. Your default position should be skepticism. Mm-hmm. You should demand really good proof. You should demand really good answers. You should ask, if this is so important, how come the Gulf states aren't doing anything? Oh, they're impotent? Well, that's their problem. That's not our problem. If this is that horrible, and I think it is, shouldn't the United Nations do something? Isn't the United Nations convention the thing that Assad is contravening? And the answer is, yeah, but Russia won't let us do it. Well, then that's a problem, isn't it? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. United Nations is broken then, isn't it? So what does it mean when the international body that you are looking to as your justification for taking action is so broken it can never take action? That's a different conversation. So you start excluding people from the conversation who shouldn't be there. The other thing he said, I think it's very important, once you've gotten the neocons out of the room, is he points out, look, that he's against intervening in Syria, but his father, who's a Jesuit missionary, is for it. Mm-hmm. And his father, he said, is a moral beacon, and therefore his father's opinion means something to him. And therefore, Chris Hayes does not think people who are in favor of intervention are monsters or depraved. They just have a different opinion. So I think, first of all, you have to remove people from the conversation who are neoconservative interventionist assholes. Mm-hmm. Second, frankly, you have to remove people like David Sirota from the conversation. Mm-hmm. People who say, well, to do anything in Syria would be a crime against humanity. No, no. Gassing citizens is a crime against humanity. Yeah. Trying to stop people from gassing their own citizens isn't a crime against humanity. It might be illegal, according to the United Nations. It might be stupid, but they're not equivalent. The Purity Caucus, who've been screaming, worse than Bush, worse than Bush, worse than Bush, are now saying that what's on the table in Syria is apparently the indiscriminate bombing of civilians. That's what we're going to do. We're going to go in and just bomb the hell out of a bunch of children because that's what Obama does. And therefore, that's the starting point for their critique of any intervention in Syria, because Barack Obama is a monster, liberals are hypocrites, and Obama wants to go in and kill Syrian civilians indiscriminately for no fucking reason other than his reputation. Those people need to be shown the door, too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then what you have left are people who, I hate to say it, are actually grown-ups.
Well, they're also torn, and it's going to be a conversation about pros and cons that doesn't come to a conclusion because the pros and cons are strong in both arguments, or should be.
And I don't doubt the passion of the people who have been jumping up and down about crimes against humanity and indiscriminate bombing.
Well, I'm actually going to send that into T-shirt hell.
Yeah.
The T-shirt is going to say, fuck you, asshole, I'm a pacifist.
Yeah. And it doesn't advance.
What is with the internet these days where there is so much itching powder on the testosterone of certain people that they've just gotten absolutely nasty with people on their side mm-hmm. who are
not pure enough,
not agreeing 100%. It's not just Glenn Greenwald or Greenwald.
No,
all kinds of people out there just saying, well, you're a warring Obama bot who just wants to go to war for your president. And I mean, I've had emails like that mm-hmm. from people, you know, how dare you say such and such.
And I
do want, this is a total aside, but I do want to apologize to those who were offended that I was using the male pronoun for Ms. PFC, Manning.
PFC Chelsea Manning.
Chelsea Manning. And it was just wrong. It was an adjustment time that I just wasn't used to it yet. And I was still using him. And I needed to switch gears and start calling her. And I didn't. So
I forgive you, Blue Gal.
Everyone who wrote me about that said, I know you are well-meaning, but you need to be aware of the way it sounds to people who are coping with transgender issues in their own personal lives and are making incredibly courageous choices. The least we can do is honor their choice. And I agree with that. Mm-hmm. That said, I just hadn't made the switch in my head yet. And in my head, I was still seeing Manning as male, and it came out that way. And that was a couple weeks ago. I'm sorry about that. But you and I did say we really do still write 2012 on our checks.
We do.
I forget my own kids' names.
Yeah, you. What's your name? It starts with something. Don't judge me. But the point of bringing up the whole litany of Republican and conservative leaders mm-hmm. who are categorically opposed to Clinton in the 90s using exactly the same language that people are using now. And then sort of communally skipping over 8 years of the same people who didn't give a shit what George Bush did, who were completely supportive of something that made Kosovo look like a rounding error, that wouldn't have dreamed of impeaching George Bush, that crushed anybody who said a mean word about George Bush, about being a traitor, completely flipped and then completely flipped back again once Barack Obama. And now we have
no problem with having Donald Rumsfeld on the TV.
And now we have people who are even crazier than they were in the 90s, even more extreme, even more obstructionist. And all I'm saying is be really careful making common cause with these people.
Mm-hmm.
Because while they might love you, as long as they can use you to advance what is one common agenda that you two have in common, they're not your friends.
Yep.
And they don't have your best interests at heart. And there are people who just viscerally hate Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are people on the left who are like that. And there are people on the right who are like that. And now they're finding each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a glorious and beautiful thing. And every now and then, they're right.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and then, they're absolutely dead right. Every now and then, they report things that are true. And we should respect that.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to look at what their larger agenda is. And their larger agenda isn't necessarily what your larger agenda is. So please don't be careful who you hop in bed with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you can end up way down a weird road that you don't want to be going down. Or you end up doing silly things. Like I'll just take an example in a comment thread, my own blog, a well-known purity person says something stupid and untrue.
Mm-hmm.
And I post it up and say, this is stupid and untrue. And because they can't admit that, because they just don't have the intellectual or moral flexibility to say, yeah, that was a fuck up. Yeah, he shouldn't have said that. Yeah, I'm not even going to yeah, but it. Because I agree with his overall views, but yeah, that was just bullshit. That was a lie.
And it was on Twitter, and he probably did it late at night after two years.
But yeah, that is not helpful.
Yeah.
Jumping up and down and screaming Nazi, Nazi, Nazi every time somebody dings your car.
Yeah.
Isn't good for Nazis. Isn't good for your reputation. Pretty much establishes.
You ding my car, you Nazi.
Yeah. And so in the run up to war, because if you bomb another country, that's a war. So what we're talking about is going to war with Syria. And it's important, I think, to have a conversation. And I'll let you know right now, I think it's a bad idea, a dumb idea. I don't know what the hell it's supposed to accomplish. But before I get to the place where apparently I'm allowed to vote on this, according to Eric Erickson, we're all allowed to vote
on this. And he's allowed to trade his vote for a vote on Obamacare.
Yeah, which is exciting. I didn't realize we were.
If you defund Obamacare, Mr. President, I'll vote for your war on Syria.
Text 1-800-SYRIA, yes or no. And I think...
If I was the president, I'd call Eric Erickson first, wouldn't you?
I would. And this is reflecting my bias as an old guy who's been through one or two or three or four or five presidential campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
If you are absolutely sure that any military action at all in Syria wouldn't just be stupid, which I think we could agree on, and it wouldn't just be maybe futile, which I think we could also agree on, but is somehow an egregious, so egregious that it is a crime against humanity, that's an awful, terrible, hideous act of depravity that is nearly unparalleled in human history. If that really is your tone, then you really have to get pissed off at Hafez al-Assad.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to get pissed off at Al-Qaeda. You really have to get pissed off at every military who ever does anything bad to anybody. And I think that the panel that Chris Hayes had struck the right balance, which was an argument between learning the lesson of Iraq and overlearning the lesson of Iraq.
And I really liked, if I can interrupt you for a minute,
please.
I also really liked what Lawrence had to say on Wednesday night when he had three congressmen on, one Republican and two Democrats. One Democrat was undecided. One Democrat was trying to draft a resolution or had drafted a resolution that gave the president much more limited power to do certain things that would be retaliatory against the use of chemical weapons, but didn't allow him any invasion forces, didn't allow him a lot of other things, really focusing on the use of chemical weapons. And that was sort of the middle, I mean, as it was portrayed on this show.
Mm-hmm.
And the third person was a Republican from Florida who said, I'm voting no. I'm absolutely voting no. No matter what happens, I'm voting no. And Lawrence O'Donnell tried. He failed. But I really got where he was going with this in terms of his Senate staffer hat, in that he tried to ask each one of them to argue for the other side, to say, well, what can you give me some arguments that would be in favor of invasion if you're against it? Or what have you heard, or what have you heard that has convinced you differently from the way you're feeling right now? What would you say to someone who did not want intervention when you had this very limited thing? Why would you, how would you argue against your own bill? He said, I know I'm asking you to argue against your own resolution, but what are the arguments for just staying out of it? And it didn't work because these are House members who have to be reelected in November, you know, next year. But you can see in a private room where senators are talking to each other, where that would be a really good exercise to just get together with other staffers and sort of play this game of, let's get to something that will pass by talking about the other side's concerns. Mm-hmm. And you and I did this over lunch today.
Yeah.
You know, we made a list, pro and con. And I think that's something that everyone, I benefited from it. You know, the arguments for, first of all, humanitarian concern for the people of Syria and the refugees around that area who are clearly suffering as a result of the chemical weapons use. Mm-hmm. Another argument for is simply international law, that we've all agreed that this should not happen and there needs to be some accountability for that.
Uh-huh.
But then the arguments against were, why does it have to be the United States?
Yep.
Why does it have to be? And you had a wonderful one from the West Wing. What was it? Something about...
Oh, yeah, this is back... I got to go back 15 years, I'm afraid. But once upon a time, Aaron Sorkin presidents, mm-hmm. Michael Douglas, the American president, and Jed Bartlett in the West Wing had identical speeches. And I reminded that the one that Jed Bartlett gave was about Damascus. And it was about the virtue of the proportional response.
Yeah, proportional response. That was it.
And it was a really interesting. I'll post the video. I found the video of it. It appears to me, given the fact that people who worked in the White House during that time were part of the advisory group. Mm-hmm. And they tried to make it as realistic or as verisimilitudinous as possible. And the president is given a series of options to strike back against Syria for shooting down an American plane.
Mm.
It was a bad guy doing a bad thing. And he's indignant. And he wants to know what the virtue of a proportional response is. And, you know, because the doctrine says, you know, they take out an airplane, we take out a radar installation. They do this, we do that. And he goes,
He wants a disproportional response.
He's minimizing. He's saying the proportional response is just the cost of doing business. But don't they know we're going to do this? Since they know it, aren't these places already evacuated? Isn't it kind of pointless to do? Why aren't we considering the disproportionate response?
Yeah, yeah.
Why aren't we considering carpet bombing Damascus as a warning to anybody who ever screws with America again?
I want to interrupt and say you are speaking about the West Wing. You are not advocating anyone. Hello?
About a TV series that's been off the air for 15 years.
Don't write us and say, how dare you suggest we carpet bomb Damascus?
No. But the conversation, thanks to George Bush's two catastrophic wars, has changed from the fictional presidents and other people having the conversation about how shall we punish these people? Shall it be proportional or disproportional? Shall we knock out a few things or shall we invade their country and occupy them?
Mm-hmm.
Two, now the crime, the one that's wildly over, you know, the top, this should never be considered because it's obviously just a grotesque, depraved act of inhumanity,
mm-hmm.
is what would have been the proportional response 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the acceptable response is now do nothing.
Yeah. And it's kind of like when... I mean, I was thinking about this morning with Bush and his war in Iraq, that it's kind of like your husband cheating on you 5 years ago, and destroying you. And then you still have to have a government, right? You still have to elect a president. All of a sudden, you see your husband having lunch with another woman,
mm-hmm.
and you walk over and splash water in her face and start screaming at your husband before you find out that's his boss,
yeah.
you know, or someone, you know, that's someone that he should be having lunch with for your sake.
Well,
and
if as long as
we've been really burned by the Bush administration.
As long as we're using bad relationship metaphors. I can attest to the fact, this has happened probably only to me. This has never happened to any other man or woman out there ever.
Yeah, sure.
But it did happen to me. A woman I was involved with before I came to my senses and married my beautiful wife. Long before that, early in our relationship, and it lasted long enough that it pretty much crippled our ability to have a relationship. Mm. I kept getting shit for things her prior boyfriends did.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I've told you a million times that. No, actually, you've never told me once. That was the guy you used to be married to. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of incidents where it was you got really abused by the last guy or the last mm-hmm. two guys. You're not talking about me.
You're talking about some other girlfriend, right?
Some girlfriend from the mists of time back during the Pleistocene. And when the West Wing was on the air.
Yeah.
And but it was, I kept having to explain to her, I'm not that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you are, because all men are that way. And finally, like, okay, I'm not that guy, but I'm going to take shit for being that guy. I'm not going to be in this relationship anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
And telling people he's not Bush.
Yeah, it's not working.
He's not Bush.
All presidents are like this. Yeah.
He makes bad mistakes. He does things I really disagree with. And striking at Syria is one of the things I disagree with. But he's really not Bush. And this front says, yes, he is. Yes, he is. They're all Bush. All of them are Bush. Except, of course, Ron Paul or Rand Paul, who will save us all. And having that conversation.
I think that's a straw man, but I'm going to stay out of it.
That's fine. But in this case, there is some idealized president who could somehow be elected and somehow fulfill all their dreams. Mm-hmm. And that's great. I'd vote for the guy or woman if that ever happened, but that's never going to happen. So it's really important if you're going to have this conversation to have it wearing the proper headgear mm-hmm. and wearing the proper lenses and seeing everything through the lens of George Bush is just not healthy. And you can agree that it's a terrible idea or won't accomplish what you want it to accomplish, or it might make things worse, or we don't know what the hell's going on over there, or the United States set this ball in motion 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, when we were deposing dictators and propping up other dictators, and everyone over there just fucking hates us because we've had our big muddy footprints all over their country, up to and including us being the British, redrawing their maps after World War I, that we should just stay the hell out of there. Because we can't seem to do any good there. And as tragic as it is to have innocent civilians, especially children, dying in a war from gas attacks, which nobody should ever do, there really isn't anything we can do as we are now that won't make the situation worse or won't make us part of the problem. That is a perfectly legitimate argument. And I'm willing to listen to anybody. I happen to agree with that argument. But that's a very different argument than Barack Obama is a depraved monster who is worse than Bush. Those are two different things. And the people who make those two different arguments might be on the same side right now, but I guarantee you they don't have the same interests at heart.
Yeah. Bible bitch.
What's up with the Bible bitch?
Bible bitch. Oh my God. I have to tell you about Bible bitch. It's so amazing. The end of days people are losing their minds because
again or still or what?
End of days or end timers. Because of Isaiah 17.
Really?
Which is about Damascus.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You think this stuff isn't in the Bible?
It's in the Bible.
Totally is. So this, I am loath to read Isaiah 17 because I don't want to give end timers any more support, but.
Let's just be clear. You're not advocating the end of the world.
No.
You're just quoting from.
From Isaiah 17. Watch this, Damascus undone as a city, a pile of dust and rubble, her towns emptied of people. The sheep and goats will move in and take over the towns as if they owned them, which they will. Not a trace of government left in Damascus.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and it, you know, and it goes on, and it's, the day is coming. Day is coming, you know.
It's almost as if this has been going on for a really, really, really long time.
Well, and that's what we talked about at lunch with Bible Bitch is, you know, Jesus said, the poor you always have with you.
And he meant that as what?
He mentioned the poor.
But he meant that as a
As an accusation, as a rebuke. Yeah, those people that believe in social welfare and so forth say, look, he is accusing people. And saying, if you'd followed the way I have taught you,
But the fact is, you'll always have the poor with you because
you don't care enough to do
right,
anything.
Right, right. Man is selfish. So I made the argument this week that the war you always have with you, and not to get people discouraged, because that's not the point. The point is to continue to work for justice and work for peace and work. I want to work for peace. I also want to work for justice for the people of Syria. And that's a really tough balancing act. I'm glad I'm not the Secretary of State. I'm glad I'm not the president. And I'm not going to tell anyone else in the blogosphere or any of our listeners what to do about this. I can only speak for myself. And what I wrote down in my prayer time this morning was that I am going to try to question my own assumptions, ask for the ability to question my own assumptions, question my own virtue, and pray, not my will, but thine be done. Mm-hmm. Knowing that this is a rocky world on this plane of existence, uh-huh. and that people in the Old Testament times were up against the same BS that we're up against now.
And have been ever since. Well, if I can...
I'm going to read Psalm 103 yeah. also, because this yeah. was the part I read to you at lunch. Psalm 103, I think this is verse 7. God is sheer mercy and grace, not easily angered. He's rich in love. He doesn't endlessly nag and scold, nor hold grudges forever. He doesn't treat us as our sins deserve, nor pay us back in full for our wrongs.
Uh-huh.
Thank God.
Thank God.
Thank God he doesn't pay us back for our wrongs.
That's not an Irish God, honey.
No. Yeah. We need to count our blessings, but and also pray for the right way to go. And I am seeking justice for the people of Syria. In all kinds of ways. And the people of Palestine. And the people of all over the world.
And no one is gassing my house. And nobody's trying to drop a bomb near my neighborhood because my governor is a lunatic.
Yeah, the white privilege thing is something that we all need to guard against in this country. Yeah.
And there is a sense of what should America do is a question that should be first asked. Where does America get off thinking it should do anything?
Yeah, yeah.
But
also the idea, Driftglass, of what do I think America should do, being such a privileged thing to say in a democracy
where exactly.
people around the world have no say. And no. In fact, someone was on, I can't remember, I think it was Chris Hayes, mm-hmm. talking about how weird it is in Middle Eastern countries, their approach that they think it's so weird that Obama asked Congress.
Yeah.
Like, well, you appointed them, didn't you? Aren't they going to vote exactly the way you tell them to, or you're going to have them killed or kick them out of office?
Oh, no, you're thinking of Chicago aldermen.
Yeah. No. The mayor will just take care of that.
But based on, you know, as through the lens of history, mm-hmm. we have godlike powers now.
Yeah.
We really can strike people like Zeus from Olympus.
Yeah, yeah.
Will. And the question then becomes a horrible one, which is, okay, now that we're gods, what do we do?
Now that we have a satellite and can find you.
Yeah.
In your house, yeah, and track you and drone you, you know, and have no consequences to us at all.
How do we control that power?
How do we control that power? Yeah. Very, very important. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's kitty is Sophie, and she's a piece of work. Just go look at her. Oh, my God. And she's a gray kitty. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. By the way, we are out of internet kitties.
We are.
So you got to get some into us, please. And you might
fake them. Fake them.
We might get 12 in one day, so then you'll have to wait a few couple weeks. But get us your pictures of your cat because we need them. Please feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go Postal Unions letter on the air unless you say otherwise.
So, Blue Gal.
Yes.
Those internet kitties that you're so forcefully defending. How are they doing this week?
Well, they've got a confession to make, Driftglass. The internet kitties are the ones who beat John McCain at iPhone poker.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Jeff Glass.
Tell me about the future, Drift Glass.
I'd rather talk about the past, Blue Gal. This is a postgraduate work at Science Fiction University. You will not be getting a grade on this. This is strictly for extra credit.
But you are allowed to take a drink.
You are absolutely allowed to take several drinks.
Unless you're driving while you listen to us.
And if you've listened to Science Fiction University before, trademark Blue Gal and Drift Glass, you will know that I never cuddle up with good science fiction, with top shelf science fiction, for its predictive value. Strictly for its predictive value.
I thought you were going to say without a drink.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's... little single malt scotch, a little science fiction, you're all set. Yeah.
That's a pretty good evening, Blue Gal.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, you don't go read science fiction to find out what the future is going to be like, right?
No, but the core of the literature itself is what if? What if certain trends go on? So big-brained people and a lot of hacks thought really hard about the future. And for instance, with the passing of Fred Pohl this week, the great and good Fred Pohl, who with Cyril Kornbluth wrote things like The Space Merchants and The Midas Plague, those things are 60 years old. And they bear rereading because the predictions they made about the observations they made about the way advertising was taking over everything.
Mm-hmm. It's very prescient, prescient.
Were played out to an absurd degree, but it turned out they weren't absurd enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's stuff like that. People who take a really hard look at the future and then imagine it completely down to the wiring and what people are wearing and the language they use and their concerns, their day-to-day concerns, and then make a story out of that. If they do that really well, that's just good literature, and it's a good literature in a genre that intrigues me. So, but the predictive value of some of the people who thought hard about the future is sometimes amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I came across this BuzzFeed article where they opened up, they didn't open up a time capsule literally, but they took a look at Isaac Asimov, the great and good Isaac Asimov, a great humanist, a great writer, one of the most prolific, if not the most prolific, science fiction writers or writers ever. He wrote everything. Science textbooks, children's stories, analysis of Shakespeare. And it was always wonderful, and it always had his light, learned touch. But they looked at his predictions that he made in 1964 about what would be happening at the 2014 World's Fair. And I'm just going to skip through some of them. They edited out the ones he got wrong, like jetpacks.
Yeah.
And I really feel cheated. I really, really feel cheated. Lack of jetpacks and lack of...
Monorails.
Although monorails are included in his prediction. And if you look at the Hyperloop, it's a monorail.
Yeah.
So, you know, it hasn't come yet. But I'm just going to skip through them quickly. And these sound like pretty obvious today. But they weren't obvious in 1964, and that's the point. The point being how commonplace these things have become is the point. So the first thing he mentions is one thing that occurs to me is that men will continue to withdraw from nature in order to create an environment that will suit them better. You know, like wraparound virtual reality, computers, CDs, headphones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is pretty commonplace.
Mm-hmm.
Go to any restaurant, go on any piece of public transportation, walk down the street and count the number of people who have withdrawn from nature and are listening to their iPhones or are texting.
Yep.
And are oblivious to the world around them.
Yeah.
Kitchen units will be devised to prepare auto meals, heating water and converting it to coffee. You know, automatic coffee makers.
Set on a timer
so that when you
wake up, it's ready.
and it has little modules that you have them now. The kind of coffee you want. You just load up the little packet.
Yeah, the little pot. Oh, gosh, those are so wasteful. But anyway.
They're incredibly wasteful. But they're shiny and they look good on your kitchen counter.
And you can have one cup of coffee.
You can. Boom.
It's all individual. It's so...
atomized.
We have just become these little units of people instead of community that shares a coffee pot.
War of all against all. You know, everyone is on their own, which is...
Although I must confess that as often as you and I say I love you when we go to bed, we also say, is the coffee set up for
exactly.
tomorrow?
Exactly. It's not what?
What? I can't go to bed then because the coffee's not set up.
Complete lunches and dinners with food semi-prepared will be stored in the freezer until ready for processing.
Wow.
That's just a given.
Yeah.
The appliances of 2014 will have no electrical cords, of course. How many devices are people carrying around now that have no cords attached to them, including phones, including, which are no longer phones?
Right.
Much effort will be put into designing vehicles with robot brains. Vehicles that can be set for a particular destination and that will then proceed there without interference by the slow reflexes of a human driver. That is, everybody's working on that.
Yeah, yeah.
All the big money tech companies are working on that, and they have been for several years.
Yep.
Robot cars. And that appeared in a lot of science fiction stories. It appeared in a couple of Arthur Clarke stories. But the idea that you could ever turn the mess that is human traffic into basically a packet switching system is something that the good people at Google are working on right now.
Yeah. You know, what occurs to me about all of this is not just that Isaac Asimov understood the direction in which technology would go, but in order to do that, you really have to understand human nature and human desire.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you think about what do humans want from technology? They want to be able to connect with other people that are their friends. And, you know, I do reject the idea that somehow you're isolating yourself when you're texting or when you're doing what do they call that? We don't have it on our fake iPhone or our
twerking. No, sorry.
FaceTime. That's what they call it. FaceTime, where you can just talk and have, you know, be able to see the person. Skyping, that sort of thing. That's what human beings want to do. They want to connect with their friends and family far away.
Yes.
And that is at a low cost or no cost. And so that's understanding that about human beings then leads you to say, yes, human beings will find a way to do this.
Yes.
Being cord free and being able to travel with your technology is something human beings want to be able to do.
And I'm sure it wasn't Steve Jobs, but it probably was, who talked about people wanting their technology to become invisible.
Yeah.
Absolutely invisible. The perfect computer is simply a screen that hovers in front of you.
But and they don't want the packaging for that technology to be invisible. That has to be a work of art.
And it has to be a work of art that your neighbor will envy.
Yeah.
You got the what? You upgraded to where? What?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I'm reading through one of the books that we got from Oxford Press.
Oh, yeah.
As a gift.
From our gift, yes.
But the evolution of science fiction from Gulliver's Travels as Sea Voyage.
Is this the short history of science fiction that you're reading? Yeah.
It's
little tiny
good.
Book. It's a little tiny essay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's the evolution of the adventure story from rivers and oceans to space.
Yeah.
And you basically just transplant the same kind of exotic adventure into further distances.
Sure you do.
And therefore you have to solve the problem of transportation.
Yep.
To get someplace fast. And that becomes a real part of early science fiction is obsession with rockets and incredibly high speed transportation that will get you from A to B really quickly. And lo and behold, here we are. As my science fiction teacher used to say, I did have a science fiction teacher who later became my friend. We live in a science fiction universe.
Yeah.
And it's easy to forget that. All right, next prediction. By 2014, only unmanned ships will have landed on Mars, though manned expeditions will be in the works.
Oh, Isaac.
I know. And in the 2014 Futurama, which is not the TV show that just went off the air, but the World's Fair that actually will never happen, it'll show a model of an elaborate Martian colony. And, of course, there are lots of models of elaborate Martian colonies. There are lots of biodomes and there's all kinds of cool shit. So, yeah, absolutely nailed that. We sent our robots first and they got there and they're doing great. And they're doing far better. They're outperforming their design specifications by orders
of magnitude. Absolutely. To me, the coolest thing I've seen in the past 10 years is how they were able to land that little vehicle on Mars with balloons.
With airbags.
Airbags. That blew my mind.
And it worked.
Anything else. Yeah, and it worked. And it worked beautifully.
Uh-huh. And the Martian people finally gave up shooting down our probes and said, fine.
Oh,
fine.
Airbag. Don't worry about it. Yeah. All right, we got to go. We're going to post this BuzzFeed article at our Facebook page. Thank you, Isaac Asimov, wherever you are.
Yeah.